Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm Adam Wilder, your host. And today we've got Rob Kittinger, who is both a friend and, you know, one of the guys, one of the people that I look to for somebody who is both a social scientist and somebody who's been able to translate those skills into the private sector, which is something Rob has done successfully. And he's always got new and innovative ideas that I'm like, huh, that's interesting. Who else is thinking about that? And so, Rob, welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks so much for having me, Adam.
So you wrote a great article that's in Global Security Review. And, you know, you spent much of your career at Sandia National Labs. And you were, you know, an organizational psychologist and somebody who did human factors research, which is something, you know, honestly, we've never talked about human factors research and its importance for the nuclear enterprise. We've never had that conversation. And so you wrote this article, and it was all about how colorblind people can negatively affect nuclear weapons safety. It was a topic I had not seen coming. But you sent me the piece, and I you know, looked at it, and I was like, wow, this is kind of interesting. And colorblindness, you know, it has a broader implication for human factors. And so can you maybe, you know, give us a synopsis of that article, and then we can, there's some other human factors topics we wanted to talk about. So give us a synopsis of the article, and then just why things like human factors matter in nuclear deterrence and the nuclear enterprise.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. So, you know, when I was at Sandia Labs, you know, there's about 15,000 employees there, mostly hard sciences. You've got physicists, engineers, some theoretical mathematicians. And, you know, they're designing components for nuclear weapons, typically. And so they may also be working in cybersecurity and other national security fields, but most of it, or a lot of it, does come to the nuclear weapons enterprise, right? And when we're building components for nuclear weapons, these are the most reliable devices on planet Earth. I won't go into specifics, but we're talking, it's not going to be 1 in 1,000 that fails. It's not going to be 1 in 10,000 that fails. It's not going to be 1 in 100,000 that fails. It might be in there somewhere, but they are testing these things so rigorously to ensure there is no chance of failure. They're upholding the mission of always, never, that a device will always function as intended when it's called upon. And it will never accidentally detonate when it's not been authorized. So we do that, but oftentimes these scientists will forget about the human element in the system, that the human is a component in these systems. It's a human that assembles the weapons that they're testing, assembles the components they're testing. It's the humans that have to relay emergency action messages and things like that. And it's the human inside these systems that I would say is the least reliable component of the system. And so that's where you bring in people like my old group. There's a human factors department at Sandia. There's the cognitive sciences department. There's threat science department. And essentially you've got about 50 to 70 social scientists, everything from anthropologists, cognitive psychologist, IO psychologist, kind of spread out. And these people are excellent at understanding the human in the system, the human in the loop, and how it's going to affect performance of these devices and the entire system when they're called upon. So that's kind of like level setting. And then I gave one example in the article, which was color vision deficiency. So I don't have lots of information about the specific instance that occurred, but at Pantex during 2023, there was some wires that got miscrossed in a device. And the idea there is that to someone who has color vision deficiency, again, I can't say for a fact that that's why it occurred, but if a human has color vision deficiency, or what we would colloquially call color blindness, right? They may see red and green as the same. And so if there's a red wire and a green wire, even in a nuclear weapon, those could accidentally be put together or crossed, right? And so separately, if the person accidentally does that and then another person comes and inspects the weapon, if they also have color vision deficiency, they could miss it, right? And you wouldn't expect that to happen very often, but it's a numbers game, right? So 8% of men have a color vision deficiency that they're born with. So, 8% is a pretty large number. And the United States Air Force does test for color vision deficiency when hiring these 2W2s that are going to assemble or disassemble nuclear weapons. But I don't personally know what Pantex plant or other national laboratories, people who are working with wiring, how they're screening their employees for these critical jobs. So there is a little bit of a knowledge gap there, but it just needs to be looked at, essentially. And I won't go too much into it, but when I was at Sandia Labs, I actually did research related to this and put forth some recommendations.
So that, this color blindness is but one example. And, we can mention, the Damascus, Arkansas incident where, a socket was dropped down and it hit a fuel line and, therefore, boom, we blow a Titan II up and we throw the warhead half a mile. Fortunately, because of the scientists at Sandia, the warhead did not detonate. So, that's a good news, bad news story, I guess. But there's these examples of mistakes being made. And fortunately, because of, it's human errors that have been made. And because of those human errors, you have an accident and an incident. But because of the mechanical safing mechanisms, the weapons never detonated. Therefore, they were 0 point, they were 0 point safe. But it brings up this, this kind of important element that oftentimes engineers and physicists don't really design into weapons. And I think this is, the point you're getting at is that there's all these ways humans can screw things up. And I know, you're familiar with, and I've written about this as well, is there's something called the reason model, where, this, he was a business professor, James Reason, and he said, you got to look at, you got to look at human activities like a piece of Swiss cheese, where there will be holes in the cheese, but you can never allow a hole to go all the way through, the block of cheese. Because then you get an actual error. So the idea is that you've got safety such that each hole never goes all the way through. And I think this is sort of what, you and your colleagues at Sandia worked on, was making sure the hole never went all the way through the block of Swiss cheese.
Yeah, and essentially, I mean, there's so many aspects to the human in a system, right? There's aspects of genuine accidents where people, just made a mistake. There's intentional errors where people are actually doing sabotage, either because they're disgruntled or they're a bad actor. And then you've got other things where even on my best day, if I'm doing a job task, I'm not going to perform the same at, lunchtime as I am at midnight. My cognitive abilities are changing during the day, and so we have kind of these natural rhythms of, of ability that are changing and fluctuating, as well as like my eyes may not work as well in the middle of the night as they do in the middle of the day. So that plus fatigue, or you had a bad night, or you got in a fight with the spouse the night before. All of these things can kind of play into how well you're going to perform. And really, it's about looking at the contrast between, we're making sure that our weapons are so extremely reliable, and just for example, say it's 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000, right? We'll say 1 in 10,000 to be more realistic, that is allowed to have an error or a mistake. But human color vision is 8%, so 8 out of 100. I mean, the numbers are not even close to being parallel. So we just need to do better at finding the reliability of the human in the system, analyzing it and considering it to make sure that always never works, even including the human in that system.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, one of the things that's we've sort of been discussing a lot here lately, and I've written several articles about the role of AI and NC3 and just how AI can be used in military applications. And you brought up a really interesting point that's one that I hadn't thought of before. So could you maybe sort of lay out your AI argument? And I think it's coming from that background that you have that, gives you the ability to think in a way that, I and, some others don't. So could you lay that out for the listeners?
Yeah, so nuclear deterrence is always about making sure there's a sustained balance, right? They don't attack us because we can retaliate. We don't attack them because they could retaliate. And so we're maintaining that deterrence threshold or balance across the entire globe at any given time. And that's why it works, right? So the issue with AI is that it's not a linear issue. And so say we have, say 5 years ago, we had 10,000 AI, software developers. I'm sure it was more than that, but for easy numbers, we'll just say 10,000. And say China has 10,000. Well, over time, because we improve AI, those same 10,000 are able to program as if it's 20,000 because AI is kind of helping them code a little bit faster. And so our ability to code goes from 10,000 to 20,000, units of labor, you can kind of think of it as. And China is trying to do the same thing. They're trying to get theirs from 10,000 to 20,000 as well. And the next issue is that essentially as you go up, we're going to cross a threshold where these AI programmers that don't exist, they're not human, are actually better than human programmers, right? And when you cross that threshold, you essentially very quickly go from, your 10,000 programmers to 1 million to 1 billion programmers because it's going to be nearly infinite on the software side, and only your bandwidth is going to be on the energy side and how much energy and GPUs you're able to tap into for processing power. And so what's problematic about this is that when we hit that, whoever hits that first, whether it's us or China or someone else, it's going to be a runaway, it's going to be a chain reaction, just like an atomic bomb, right? Which is kind of an interesting way to think about it. It's going to be this unfettered chain reaction of ability that completely blows away the competition because we'll scale, when they're at, say going from 10,000 to 20,000, if they're only 6 months behind us, they could still be at 30,000 and we scale to 1 million overnight because of just being able to put more energy and GPUs into it. So the issue is that as they see this happening or as we see this happening, it's going to affect our deterrence logic because when they see us rapidly getting ahead, and if we're 6 months ahead of them, they may try to sabotage us or do other things to hinder us. But what's going to happen is if they fail at hindering us and they see one of us is going to continue getting closer to that finish line, right? And when you know you lose everything, if the other person gets to that finish line first, you do whatever you have to. And so it's almost a logical thing that when sabotage doesn't work, when cyber attacks don't work, you're going to go kinetic. You're going to blow up the data center with a kinetic bomb, right? And so we have to be mindful of that, and that this is the future that we're rapidly approaching. We have a little bit of time right now to kind of think about it, think about how it affects our nuclear deterrence theory and posture. But we need to be thinking about this, and we need to know that the enemy is thinking about this.
Join the ANWA Deterrence Center and NucleCast at the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, January 26th through 28th at the Crystal Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. This premier event brings together decision makers from government, national laboratories, and industry for strategic updates, high-value networking, and practical conversations that drive partnerships and business. Sign up through the link on our website to receive a 15% discount at anwadeter.org. We hope to see you there.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And it's one where, you know, there's been this significant concern because, you know, every year the Chinese produce more computer engineers than we have total. And so there's been a bit of concern that they can, you know, just outperform us. But, you know, under your logic, you know, if we can sort of hit that magic point where we've built AIs that can then replicate at a speed that just can't be matched, then that can be our, you know, sort of our ace in the hole. But it's all going to come down to, you know, can we produce enough energy to then run the data centers, which the data centers then become, you know, that's your DGZ for, you know, for your primary targets. And for the United States, we've got sufficient energy resources, you know, to sort of do this thing. It's the Chinese who sort of don't have the energy resources. And so it sort of creates an alternative scenario in which, you know, like what causes the war? And rather than it being Taiwan, you know, it can be, you know, this scenario that you sort of lay out, which is you know, it's quite an interesting one that I don't think a lot of folks have thought about. I hadn't thought about it before.
Yeah, and there's several kind of underlying problems and considerations. So one is the U.S. is ahead on energy compared to China. So we have more energy resources, we have more compute power than they do, and really, you know, their strong suit is the number of people they can throw at the problem, right? To your point, you know, a billion people, the top 10% of their IQ, you know, is still 100 million people. That's 25% of our population. So, or even greater than 25% of our population. So we can't compete on people. But what's interesting about all of this is that as we hit this finish line where AI has super intelligence greater than human intelligence, then it actually scales, like you're saying, to a fact where we're able to accomplish intellectually more than they are, even with having more people. What's kind of interesting about that also is if you're thinking about this from like a communist society, the humans that were your strength are now a burden, right? They consume resources. They need food. They need shelter. They need fuel, heating. Whereas the United States has that same intellectual capability through AI without the human bodies. And so we'll see how they handle that. It's going to be interesting.
And you know, sort of a, I guess, a corollary to this challenge that you've sort of laid out is an interesting one in the sense that, you know, the United States, if it can reach it, and it can, you know, sort of reach that, you know, that tipping point, I guess, if that's what you want to call it, has the ability to sustain it, you know, in very much a way that China does not. And yet, I wonder, because of the regime, does China, you know, very much seek to, you know, is it going to employ nuclear weapons? Because let's say hypothetically it can cause a, you know, it detonates an EMP over the United States, you know, to take down our power grid and, you know, to take out those data centers. You know, it sets up kind of a very interesting scenario. And we've seen a couple of books written here in the last handful of years that have these sort of nuclear scenarios. And what you're offering is a very different sort of way to get there, and a very different sort of maybe how many do you use and what effect are you trying to achieve? And I guess one of my questions for you is if, you know, you're prognosticating, do you see this as, you know, is this like, you know, science fiction that we're talking about? Is it, you know, it's coming and it's going to happen? Or is it more like quantum computing, which is about to happen tomorrow, and it's been about to happen tomorrow for the last 20 or 30 years? So where is this scenario that you see? What's its probability, and how do you see it, you know, shaping deterrence and then the employment of nuclear weapons and then their role in, you know, security?
Yeah. So a few things. I actually think that AI is underhyped. I know everybody is talking about AI, and there's people talking about an AI bubble, and but really, truly, people aren't considering that AI is fundamentally different than, say, quantum computing. It takes scientists to put together the quantum computing machine, right? AI is helping build itself, and as it helps build itself, it gets even faster and even better. And so this is a runaway chain reaction type of event. You know, I don't think we can underhype AI, at least in the next 5 to 10 years. I don't even think we have time to build the nuclear reactors I think we should start on building nuclear reactors to power all of this progress. But I think we'll reach superintelligence before we even finish the first reactor if we start building it, you know, today. It's not going to be 10 years away. It's going to be 5 years away.
So then do we have is it like a necessity to beat the Chinese to this point? And then because we view this as a necessity, do we therefore say, hey, all the shackles are off, you know, ethical AI and all that kind of stuff? We can't afford that. You know, we've got to get to super intelligence before they do, or else it's their civilization versus our civilization. And therefore, you know, we sort of, you know, put the wheels in motion for, you know, I don't know, Terminator or whatever people most fear.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fine balance, is how do we compete with China while also trying to prevent AI from itself, you know, taking out the US and China, right? So, you know, it is a fine balance to do that. I wouldn't say completely unshackle it and throw caution to the wind with ethics. But one thing that I would say that I'm kind of most concerned about is the US was firmly winning this up until like 6 months ago. And China had several breakthroughs where they were able to do nearly the same AI compute power with much less compute resources and much less energy resources. And so that really gives them an edge on the energy side because of that efficiency. And we may catch up and do that also. But it's, you know, do we go after being energy efficient, or do we just go purely after super intelligence is kind of the bigger issue. And one thing I think the U.S. government could do, and I'm not, I am politically, I'm more libertarian and free market type minded person. But one of the things that, you know, if we're going to subsidize different industries, I would say subsidize the AI industry at this point in time more than corn or other crops and things like that. But the reason is because if Chinese compute power is so much less expensive, all of the AI companies are going to pour money into their AI industry. because it's just cheaper, right? And they're going to be using it and they're going to be getting better and better. So I think if we can offset the cost here on the US homeland, and maybe subsidize those costs a little bit to consumers, we'll keep pouring money into the US, in the AI industry there. And that's, I think, a very important technical advantage, especially on the earlier side of this race.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting question to ponder. Now, it is that time in the show where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I rub my magic lamp, Bob, of course, grants three wishes to all guests. And so with that in mind, Rob, what is your first wish?
My first wish would be, oh man, my first wish would be that the US would just be more efficient or have some kind of breakthrough on the algorithm side that helps us be more energy efficient. My second wish would be that we can go back in time and build some large nuclear reactors, 10 years ago. And my third wish is that, all of our software developers, would just be supernaturally blessed, and come up with super intelligence and how to get there before our adversaries, and can help keep us under the safe, warm blanket of freedom. And yeah, that's that's my three wishes.
So when we reach super intelligence, does that mean whenever I go to, ChatGPT 7 and I ask it to give me a list of articles on a topic, that those articles will be real articles, not ones that ChatGPT has created? Is that what you're telling me super intelligence will get me? Or is that even
I
too
mean,
much to
I
ask
think
from that?
no, at super intelligence, you're going to be able to have PhD level written articles, and you could just get a billion of them completely unique and with new breakthroughs and new conversations that no human has ever thought about in the past. So it's no longer just building off of existing human thought, but truly innovating and thinking through problems. And I think, one of our hangups from the article writing side is that they get the citations wrong. It'll be getting those citations right.
Well, it's interesting. I'm teaching students right now, and one of the things that they have a tendency to do, and these are military officers, is they, use ChatGPT quite a bit. And one of the things I've noticed with ChatGPT, and I wonder, and I use this, example as kind of a broader question about the utility of AI and the algorithms and the information it provides, is that when they're repeating what ChatGPT says matters most, it's often primarily word salad that really doesn't have intrinsic value. And so I wonder about, with this concern that, general intelligence is going to sort of make us useless. But will it really make us useless? Because there's a lot that, as I read, essays and things that have been heavily written by AI, I don't get a lot of value out of it. And so I wonder, like with the coding that it, with the billion AI coding number and with others, will the quality and utility be what we would want it and need it to be?
Yeah, that's an interesting, it's an interesting question. So yeah, I wouldn't worry about the quality being there. The quality will be there. What's more interesting is maybe that AI is going to end up writing its own language that's more efficient than English. It's going to be the most efficient way to communicate data, and then it's going to be talking to itself in this efficient language. And we're going to be left behind in the dirt, with our English sentences, and it'll be able to write English. It's not, going to be a problem, but it'll just see our communication as the inefficient communication method, And so it'll be an interesting next several years, and we'll see how we all get through it together. I did want to go back to one thing you had kind of asked about on the deterrence side and how I see this playing out. I mean, I think, the obvious things are either attacks, just like other countries have attacked nuclear scientists. I can see attacks starting to occur on our top minds in the AI world, whether that's being made to look like car accidents or if it is outright assassinations. I could also see cyber attacks ramping up and getting more and more malicious. They're also going to be using AI to evolve these malicious computer code attacks. So it's a moving target. It's going to be much more harder, difficult to identify. And then as they continue to do those types of sabotage, we will start moving into kinetic sabotage where they may try and take out power plants that are powering different data centers. They may start actually exploding devices or doing even just like swatting buildings, like calling it in a bomb threat, even if there isn't one, just to get employees out of the building. So all of that's going to continue to ramp up, until there are actual bombs going off at data centers and at large compute resource facilities. Amazon facilities would be big targets, the data centers, as well as nuclear power plants and other things like that. Now, when we start ramping up and it becomes a kinetic war, I mean, that's where we have to start worrying about things going into a nuclear threshold. Or if, and you know, and the other side of this is if there is such a large logical ramp up, AI might say, hey, the only way to beat this is to actually jump ahead, escalate to de-escalate, and don't even worry about the little sabotage and things like that. We need to launch an EMP to kick this thing off even. I mean, I don't know what it's going to come up with. I just think that AI will be telling us this is how to cause the dominoes to fall in the right order so that we win.
All right, Rob Kittinger, thanks for painting a very bleak picture of the future
Yeah,
and
sleep
of
tight.
yeah. So thanks for that. Always, of course, always interesting. It's good to have you back. You bring great topics every time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Adam.
Of course, and thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you on the next episode. Well, Rob is one of those creative guys who he's always thinking of things that I hadn't thought of. And so, it's always great to talk to him and to hear what his take on things is. And he'd written a great article for Global Security Review. I really didn't think, or I don't think about human factors that often. I mean, you're aware of them, but we don't really think about them often. So it was good to talk to him, and then really interesting to get his take on AI and just sort of think of another way that AI could totally make things terrible for the world. So that seems to be what we like to do with AI these days anyways. So it was a great interview.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.